From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 326, recorded live Thursday, June 28th, 2012. This episode is brought to you by Telerik, offering the best in developer tools and support. Online at telerik.com. And by franklins.net, training developers to work smarter, and now offering GesturePack, a powerful gesture recording and recognition system for Microsoft Kinect for Windows developers. Details at gesturepak.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Dave Ward about JavaScript, web APIs, performance, and the direction the web is taking.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And today I want to talk about the direction that the web is going, and I've got Dave Ward with me on the line. How's it going, Dave?
Hey, going pretty good.
I always like talking to you because you really, I think, have your finger on kind of the pulse of what's happening on the internet. And I know that you have a good, you have a purist attitude, because I know that I've worked with you on code and we've paired where you've said, this isn't really how I would do it and I want it to look nicer. But you're also a pragmatist and you're willing to go in kind of the direction that is going to get the work done. And I think that we're seeing more and more that people are not wanting to render all of their angle brackets and their HTML on the server side. It seems like the browsers are fast enough now that people are shoveling JSON around. Is that a fad, or do you think that's the way the web's going?
You know, that's an interesting question, because if you had asked me that a couple of years ago, I would have very clearly said, you know, JSON all the way. Why would we even bother rendering on the server? But now we have mobile devices that account for such a huge amount of the usage on the web, and they're almost as slow as, you know, IE6. You know, it's almost like we've moved backwards a little bit there. So I think it's a really complicated question.
But at the same time, though, Google just announced mobile devices, tablets in this case, that had quad processors. Is it one of these things where every time we think that a mobile machine or a small machine will not have the power, a few minutes later it has the power, and we should we shoot the moon and just assume that everyone will have 3D hardware accelerated browsers in the next year or two?
And virtual reality goggles too, right?
Of course.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Yeah, exactly. No, I think that's a great point. I think it's a temporary problem, certainly. And, I've always been a fan of using an API of some sort that returns JSON. Even back when we worked on Nerd Dinner, you know, we did a bit of that. Mm-hmm. And I've always liked client-side templating. I think it's better because when you have the data, you can do more granular updates. You can do things that really wouldn't even come to mind as possibilities when you're rendering whole, pages or even just partials on the server side, because the granularity just isn't there. You can't do the neat stuff like fading out a single line or updating just a single value and making a flash to show that it updated. Small stuff like that makes a great user interface, but it's very difficult if you're not doing the rendering on the client side. So I do think that's the way it's going to go. And, for good user experience, you really do need that.
What do you think about what happened recently with Twitter and some of the focus that they've been putting on performance? I assume you're familiar with their recent kind of controversial blog post. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what a hashbang is and why those show up in URLs, what Twitter did a couple years ago and what they did now, and why that matters to people who care about the web.
Sure. So if you want to maintain state on the client side, browser history, you can't change the URL. You couldn't before. You can now with an HTML5 API, but it's still not available in a lot of browsers that people are using. If you manipulated document.location to change the URL in the browser, it triggered a full page refresh, which generally isn't what you want when you're doing sort of a client-side rich application. And so the way that people work around that to create an application sort of like Twitter or Facebook or something like that, where it's a lot of things are changing without page reloads, you manipulate the hash portion of the URL, which is, what you see when you go to a Twitter URL today, or maybe not today. I think they actually have started reverting that. But in the past, you see that hash bang and then a path after that. Mm-hmm. And what that does is it allows you to change the path on the client side without triggering those page reloads. And of course, the problem with that is the hash is not sent to the server at all. So if I go to twitter.com hash, Encosia, for example, mm-hmm. All Twitter gets on its server is just twitter.com, and it has to send down the whole client-side application. And then the client-side application has to parse out, what's in the hash, sees Encosia, then make another call back to the server, to the API, get, you know, whatever stuff it was going to render for Ecosia, and then finally build me a page. So, you know, it's a lot slower than if I just went to twitter.com/Ecosia, and it could serve me up the right thing the first time around. And so that's what the performance problems have been around that.
So let me see if I understand this. When you hit, you know, Hansman.com, and there's an anchor that's on the current page, this is kind of in the old web, the web of, you know, the original web, you would have like a long document, like chapter one, chapter two, chapter three, all on one page. And then you would say A, href, A being anchor, and you'd say, this is named, you know, chapter two. And then you could have another link that would refer to hash, the number sign, shift three on the US keyboard, and that would refer to that chapter, and you would have an in-page link, right? And
yeah,
that would not
exactly
hit
right.
That would not hit the server. And we would use that for funny hacks and stuff in the pre-Ajax world, right? Where we would jump up and down on a page and the server would never know about it.
That's exactly so right. We're taking something that it was designed exactly for that, the in-page navigation, you know, years and years ago, and then we've sort of found that was the only thing that we could do before this new HTML5 API to be able to find some way to change the, you know, the browser history without reloading a page.
So when you click around to a hash anchor, you're not, there's no way to hear about that on the server side. And then in September of 2010, when Twitter built their UI all around this, and we started seeing these hash bangs, $!!! style URL. Everyone thought that's the way the web was going. And in fact, all of Twitter's permalinks turned into this. Like, we saw every single URL change to this. I'm surprised. Like, when it happened, like, how could anyone have thought that was a good idea?
I agree with you. I didn't think it was a good idea then. And now they're saddled with a maintenance nightmare forever, because even when they revert back to normal URLs for performance, they still have to somehow support these old permalinks, at least they should.
Well, they're going to have to sniff them, aren't they?
Yeah, they're still going to need Twitter.com to be able to have some, at least some bootstrapped client-side code there that can detect that and realize, oh, hey, I need to still, you know, do some sort of redirect to where this should be. So, they really painted themselves into a corner with that one. I don't think it was a good idea at all.
Didn't Google go and put in some code in their stuff to, they're starting to have JavaScript in the Googlebot such that they can see when things like this are being done, and they can still index the information?
Well, so that's why the bang, the exclamation mark, comes after the hash. That's a convention that Google recommended. The hash is all that's necessary. You don't need to do a hash bang to get around the browser navigation. The hash bang is something that Google wants so that it sees that as a convention. And then if, say, we had Hanselman.com /hash bang Dave. And what Google would do is they would then, if they ever saw a permalink to that, they would make a request to Hanselman.com /?. They would do a query string. So that does get sent to the server, and it would be unescaped fragment equals Dave. And so it's expecting your server to be able to serve up something at least for it to index that corresponds to what that hash bang URL was showing to users, so that you can actually work around the, you know, the fact that it, Googlebot generally couldn't run all that client-side code to show it what the users were seeing.
One of the interesting things that you said that got me thinking was the idea that we want the speed of an application, but we want the web to be powerful like the web is. And web APIs are supposed to be amazing and supposed to be powerful, and they're supposed to be the backbone on which we rest all these applications. And what Twitter had attempted to do really was create an application that ran on the user's browser, but consumed their Twitter REST API as if it were a client, any other kind of a client, which is basically saying the Twitter website is no different than any other client, no matter where it's running, except in this instance, the entire application, the Twitter application composed of all the different images and CSS and JavaScript, had to come down a lot more often than with an application. Is this showing an underlying problem with the whole web versus application model? And we just need the concept of web apps to really happen?
You know, I think this is a case where Twitter may have, there's always a line between what is a website and what is a web application. Obviously, if I go to Gmail, I know that's a web application. I know that I'm not expecting to have durable links to documents there or any of those sort of things. Whereas I think, Twitter is trying to straddle that line a little bit farther toward the application side than it really should. I think really we think of Twitter more as a resource full of documents. They happen to be tweets, but we expect permalinks to work, and we care less about, loading up an entire Twitter application every time we want to view one tweet that someone links to us. I think that it's not that the web can't be a rich application in when it should be. I think just in the case of Twitter, I think they went too far.
Mm-hmm. Well, and now what they've done is they've calling it the optimizing to time to first tweet. And apparently they've dropped it down to a fifth of what it was. So, I mean, that's a big number, but, phrased differently, it's 80% faster. That's pretty crazy. That means that it was super slow before. And I know that I've seen this when I'm logged into Twitter. If you notice that flash where you see the background of your own
yeah,
Twitter
sure.
background, and then suddenly you see the tweet you linked to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
That's really unfortunate. And the thing that I think is most interesting, that if we dig into their little announcement here on improving performance on Twitter, is that it came down to dependencies. That the issue was that they were just downloading so much JavaScript, and there's really no good way to tell on a page-by-page basis what's needed. And I think more and more of us, as we find different plugins and little snips of JavaScript, no one really has a good sense about what code path is being used on a per-page basis.
That's something where I've long advocated that, especially in the jQuery ecosystem, which is, when we talk about JavaScript and the web, I mean, it's sort of implied that we're talking about jQuery for most people.
Mm-hmm.
The ecosystem of plugins is just gigantic, and it's so tempting to put every eye candy plugin that you find on your site.
Right.
But I've long advocated that, you should really try to implement it yourself first, because mm-hmm. there are so many times when, say, that fancy gallery or slider plugin, turns out that for the implementation on your site, it's just a few lines of code. I mean, very, very short. And the big plugin really is handling all the edge cases and corner cases for every different sort of way you might want to use it. That you're never, exactly like you said, you're never using all those code paths. Mm-hmm. And then it's so easy to build up that big bloated site like, Twitter did.
Yeah. There's a really interesting project from Microsoft Research called JS Meter. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
I think this would be right up your alley. I can smell a Dave Ward blog post coming even as I tell you about it. So JS Meter goes and measures the runtime behavior of a JavaScript program. And it's meant to help the IE10 team, figure out their JavaScript engine and optimize it. But what's interesting is that they've gone and looked at like typical web pages. And it turns out, according to the chart that they published on the IE10 blog, that the average web page only executes about 40% of the JavaScript that they download. So think about that, right? You're literally downloading a whole bunch of code and not using it. And that's where things start becoming really interesting. Where do you solve that problem, right? Do you download as many JavaScript libraries as you can and cache them all and make jQuery built into the browser so that you never have to download jQuery again? Do you let the CDN handle that? Or do you make the JavaScript engine really smart and somehow parse just the minimal amount of work that you want to do? Because you want to find a balance between jitting, which is, just-in-time compiling stuff, and what do you do with the rest? How do you assume that, this website may use these other libraries? Do I want to get ready for those? Do I want to parse this or parse that? I guess in IE10, the new JavaScript library does syntax-only parsing. And then doesn't actually go and do the work of building the syntax tree until the function's about to be invoked. But it brings up a really interesting question, which is kind of the underlying question of our entire conversation, is that whose responsibility is it when you're executing this kind of code? Is it the server? Is it the client? Is it the operating system? Is it the browser? Is it the CDN?
Well, I think definitely the advances in the browsers, like you said, the IE blog on MSDN, they have a great post about those new optimizations they're doing with the syntax tree parsing and trying to cache the already parsed tree when they can between page views and things like that. That's awesome. I mean, that is really great innovative work. And, you know, I'm sure that the V8 engine is probably doing similar things. You know, they do great innovation there too. But, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier, you know, mobile browsers and, you know, you have a browser in your TV now and probably in your refrigerator in a few years. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think that it's reasonable to expect to have that kind of optimization if your site falls flat and takes, you know, 20 seconds to load without IE10. That's mm-hmm. not good at all. And it is a good question. You know, in some cases, I've definitely been feeding server-rendered HTML to mobile devices when I do jQuery mobile apps, because I just found that doing the rendering on the client side was painfully slow.
Really? And how are you doing that? Because that brings up the kind of the final level of optimization, which is developer time optimization, right? I mean, everyone's so excited about dynamic languages and doing all these things on the client, but you're really talking about what is an optimization where you recognize this is something that needed to be on the server. Was there a tool that told you this, or did you just figure it out?
I just figured it out. We didn't even have to profile. I would say that in some cases it would be nice just to profile and see. But in this case, it happened to be Android devices. The browser, at least pre ice cream sandwich, is just so painfully slow. The difference was an order of magnitude or more. And so we realized we had to do something. And it turned out that when we fed it HTML, it did just fine. And this was not something that needed to be in the app store. So that wasn't really a hurdle we had to worry about. Mm-hmm. So we did that and it worked out pretty well. And, you know, like I said earlier, I really would prefer to send down JSON and render that somehow on the client side. I think it's a better approach, but really you do have to balance. You know, I think that's probably what Twitter's learning now. They tried to go too far into the future too fast and they had to pull back a little bit.
As developers that are excited about using plugins and using the ecosystem that's available to us, are the tools available to us on the client side as a client side front end developer to figure out what is being executed? Like, for example, I know that the modernizer guys insisted that people stop installing and downloading the complete modernizer. Like jQuery used to have like everything jQuery, like jQuery.js, and here it is. But we've seen with things like JS Meter that we might only use 40-50% of a library. So we're sending the entire library down, but only executing half of it. Modernizer has said, no, you have to make a custom one if you want to use our product, and tell us the features you want and we'll build you a custom modernizer library. And they've actually said they don't want their library on CDNs. But how would one even go and determine the dependencies of what is the usage of these common libraries that my application uses?
Well, I think there's a few things there. One, modernizer is something that you have to include in the head of the page instead mm-hmm. of putting it at the bottom where you would generally put something for performance reasons. So that's a big part of why they don't want it up there, because every byte counts there in terms of download time and parsing time. You know, cause that's going to block, cause it has to be in the head. It's going to block, you know, any of the page showing whatsoever. It's a, you know, horrible performance tax. Mm-hmm. Modernizer is just, you know, awesome enough that it's worth putting it there. You know, I disagree when it comes to CDNs though, at least for things like jQuery and very popular libraries like that. I would say the validation plugins, another one that is so widely used, it makes sense. Mm-hmm. Because so many people use it. I've actually done a bit of testing on this. People may be familiar. I have several blog posts over the years about this, where I've actually run a spider across the Alexa top 200,000 and then eventually 1 million sites, just trying to see, you know, what are they using? Are they using CDNs? Mm-hmm. Which CDN are they using, et cetera? And I found that the Google CDN on the Microsoft podcast?
You don't need to feel bad about anything. I may work for the man, but I happily, like everyone else, you know, I'm not married to anything. I'm married to success is what I care about.
I was joking.
I'm just saying it's a good point though. Like I'm using the IE10 blog as a reference, but I don't care. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. But I found that the Google CDN is so widely used. I mean, just tons and tons of sites that have, you know, in the Alexa top 1,000, especially, there's at least a few dozen. Mm-hmm. And you have to think that the amount of reach that has on a daily basis, the hundreds of millions of browser caches that primes, is just too big of an opportunity to pass up. It means that if you say Stack Overflow uses it, they do. Mm-hmm. And so if then on my blog, I also reference the exact same URL. When someone hits, you know, and probably most of the people that come to my blog have been to Stack Overflow, you know, several mm-hmm. times before they come to my blog. So when they hit my blog, there's not even an HTTP request for jQuery. It just comes off their disk instantly. It doesn't even have to check for a 304 not modified. It's just instant off the disk. And that's huge, I think. It doesn't help with the parsing and all of that. But, you know, I think that with the libraries that are really widely used, finding the most popular CDN and using it is a great thing to do on public-facing sites.
When does it know whether or not it has to go? And when do I know whether or not my system is going to go and look to see if it needs to update something? Like you made a throwaway comment there that it doesn't even need to go and say 304 not modified. When do I know that that's going to happen and not going to happen?
There are a couple of headers, HTTP headers. When the client first got to a page and did not have it cached, say they hit Stack Overflow, you know, at one point and they needed to request that, it made it down to that script line with the reference to the CDN, checked its cache, did not have it, so it requests it. And in the response that contains jQuery, there's also some HTTP headers. There's an expires header, which people are probably most familiar with. There's also a cache control header that can do the same thing. And in those headers, you can specify this you know, resource is good for the next month, year, 20 years, whatever. Mm-hmm. And the browser then knows, it stores it with that metadata, and knows that the next time it encounters that exact same URL, it can just pull it from disk because it already knows that, you know, it's been instructed that this is good for a certain period of time.
Hmm. Do you what tools do you use when you're doing this kind of work? What are you a Sublime person? Are you Visual Studio? What do you do? Because again, you're a pragmatist, so you're not married to a particular tool set. I know you use what makes you happy.
You know, I've been all over the map. I really like Visual Studio 2012. I do a lot of MVC for work currently, and I use it daily for that. For light work, where I'm just opening up one JavaScript file and I want to edit it real quick, or maybe I'm just beginning to work on something and I haven't figured out even what backend it's going to have yet, so maybe I don't, maybe it doesn't make sense yet to use Visual Studio. Mm-hmm. I like Sublime Text too a lot. I use a PC as my primary development machine, but I do also have a MacBook Air that I roam around with. So it's really great to have the same environment on both. And then I also, for some of my heavier work, when I go into, say, WordPress land, or sometimes when I'm working on Node, I like to use JetBrains PHP Storm or WebStorm if you don't need the PHP support. It's a bit heavier, and it sort of feels a little less at home on Windows. You know, it looks sort of like Eclipse. You know, you can kind of tell that it's a cross-platform app, but it works fantastically well for Node and PHP. I've just started dabbling with WebMatrix 2. They added sort of, they snuck in some really impressive support for Node. I didn't even realize it was there until I saw a blog post a couple of weeks after it came out.
Yeah.
And so that's some really impressive stuff they're doing with it.
Yeah, they are spending a lot of time in that. It's going to be interesting to see what the WebMatrix team does as far as, like, is this going to be a different direction? Like, is it meant for a different audience? Or is it going to be a playground for features that are going to eventually show up in Visual Studio itself?
Well, we got Razor from that, right?
Yeah, I guess we
did.
The
WebPages product that was kind of, you know, built in with WebMatrix. And then next thing you know, it's one of the best things about MVC3.
Yeah. What is it about Sublime Text that makes people so happy? And I'm wondering, like, is it the speed at which it loads, or is it the text, that it's a more accessible way to manipulate text than maybe Emacs or Vim, something like that?
You know, I do not use it to its fullest potential. So for me, it's definitely not the the high-end manipulation stuff that sort of is analogous to Vim or Emacs. I think for me, it's just the speed. Not even the speed that it opens at, but the speed between when I press a key and I see the result. It seems like it's just a little faster than anything else I've ever used. It just feels so fluid and fast to use it.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds weird. It's almost a subjective thing to say, but I've heard a lot of people say it too. I think maybe it's just one of those 10 millisecond things that's hard to quantify, but is actually important.
I wonder if, I mean, it might be blasphemy to say this, but I wonder what it'd be like to have Sublime, the editor, inside of Visual Studio, or if Visual Studio, like the Chrome, is too heavy for that to, like, blasphemy to take this kind of thing that is perceived as being slow and connect it to this thing that is perceived as being fast. But I wonder,
you know,
if
my understanding that a lot of the speed issues in Visual Studio, and I wouldn't even say speed issues, because in my experience, Visual Studio is plenty fast. I have not had any serious problems with it.
You have an SSD, right?
About, what's that?
You have an SSD.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm wondering if Visual Studio hits the disk a lot. I know a lot of work has been done on 2012. Like, let me see if I hit... I'm going to hit Visual Studio 2012 here. 1.1.2.1. Okay, so it's already up. So it's look, my Visual Studio launches in a second and a half. And Sublime, where's Sublime? 1.1.2.1.000. Yeah, so I mean, you know, they both launch in a second or two. But is it just that people have slower hard drives? Or that I'm just spoiled with a fast computer?
You know, when it comes to Visual Studio and people talking about the speed, I think they're generally talking about the speed once it has already started. You know, it's my understanding from the people on the team that I've talked to that it does so much work. You take for granted how much work it does every time you hit a key, and it has to be able to you know, do some of the advanced things that it does.
Yeah.
It's so easy to take that for granted, but it does really do some incredible things for you.
Yeah. I think that one of the things that
Sublime
nice
doesn't
that,
really do anything.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I got in an argument with a guy at a conference I was at recently. I spoke at the Arizona Day of Scott Goo that we do every year. And we had about 1,000 people. And we had a guy who thought that IntelliSense and some stuff that we were doing in Visual Studio was basically stolen from Sublime. And I reminded him how much older other text editors were that were doing similar kinds of things. But, what I think is going to be interesting is not Sublime versus Visual Studio, which I don't think is a contest. They're different editors for different reasons, and more the in-browser editors. Because if you write some JavaScript in Visual Studio, like if you write var a equals quote Scott and then type a dot, you'll get IntelliSense that indicates that Visual Studio actually knows that a is a string and not an integer. So you'll be able to two-upper it and do things like that in substring. And if you said var a equals one, you would get decimal and integer related type things. That's because it's running JavaScript right there. For something like Sublime to do that would require a lot of work on their part. So it focuses more on like text manipulation as being really, really agile for text manipulation. But if you move your IDE into the cloud and you have something like Cloud9 or Bracket or any of these other JavaScript based editors, it's in a JavaScript environment already. Then not necessarily the general problem of IntelliSense, which works for any language in Visual Studio, F-sharp, VB, C-sharp, but the JavaScript-specific IntelliSense then becomes less of a problem, wouldn't you think?
That's an interesting question. You know, I when you started going down that path, I immediately figured out where you were headed. And then the first thing I thought of was, so what happens when you type an infinite loop in your single-threaded JavaScript environment in your browser, in your IDE? Does it hang the whole IDE for the timeout period of your JavaScript engine?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know. Presumably, they come up with some way to do that. And maybe, I don't know. I actually haven't seen what happens in V8 or in Chakra or any of these other JavaScript environments. If they're smart enough to detect that, that would be, we'll no doubt hear from the listeners about that. But presume that they can solve that problem in some way. Does IntelliSense become a non-issue in a browser-based environment, an IDE? And even then, would I trust my browser to not crash while I was doing all that work? You know, Cloud9 is definitely betting on that.
Yeah. You know, I think Cloud9, for me, I just saw their new release, and the killer feature there is the collaboration, being able to do the real-time editing. That's really neat. That's something I definitely wish I had several times in the past. And in terms of it replacing something like Sublime or Visual Studio. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, you know, the easy statement is like, oh no, you know, we'll never use browser tools for that. Kind of like Photoshop. We'll never do Photoshop in the browser, but you know, maybe we will. We've seen so much maturation in that area over the past few years, and things are getting so fast. I definitely wouldn't count it out.
No, absolutely not. Well, Cloud9, they just added Azure support. They've got an offline version, a little application for Mac and for Linux. They'll deploy to Heroku. They'll deploy to Cloud Foundry, Windows, Azure. I don't know.
It's really cool how you can start up a GitHub project and start editing it in Cloud9 and then deploy it right over to Azure using their new Node support for websites. I can do a Node project right there and push it over. And that's really neat. I mean, that's great integration.
What kinds of applications can I do? I guess it supports a lot of different languages.
Yeah, I'm not an expert in Cloud9 by any means, but I believe it'll edit anything. But I think it has good support for, did they just say PHP and Ruby that they just added, and then Node they've had for a while?
Yeah. It brings up a really interesting question that is, you know, we joke about the browser just being like, you know, another terminal, but it is becoming an OS on top of an OS, you know, and JavaScript is clearly the operating. I said before, you know, it was the assembly language of the web. It's becoming the virtual machine for the web, frankly. Java has lost, JavaScript has won. The VM is there, so it's not much more to say that JavaScript is the operating system of the internet.
Yeah, I guess that's what Google is betting on with the Chromebooks and Chrome OS.
Yeah, exactly. And it was which makes me funny. It makes me miss HP's WebOS all the more, like the idea of a tablet-based, entirely JavaScript operating system.
Yeah, you know, everything I saw about and of that seemed like it was really nice. It seemed like they did a much better job than the other attempts so far.
And actually, last question, because I was thinking about JavaScript and operating systems. Have you written any JavaScript on Windows 8? Because I haven't tried it, and I was wondering, as a JavaScript person, is it easy to write a JavaScript app for Windows?
You know, I installed Windows 8 solely for the reason of getting into that development space, because I think it's really exciting. I am genuinely excited about the potential of Windows 8 development using HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. I have not had a chance to build an app from scratch yet, but I've new project up some of the templates, and I've poked around and looked at, you know, how they're laid out and some of those sort of things.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it looks pretty clean. You know, I think that they're doing things right. Obviously, there's still some changes to come in the API, I think it's actually going to be pretty good. I think that a JavaScript developer, as long as they are pretty comfortable with MVVM as an approach to the rendering, I think they could sit down with that and they would look at the approach to it and think it was a good approach. They wouldn't think it was this Microsoft junk, you know?
Yeah. So you think that JavaScript is a safe place to be? Like, if you're a web developer, it's great that you know Ruby or you know PHP or you know ASP.NET, but if you've got to know JavaScript to be successful right now.
To be successful, maybe not. I see people definitely getting away with knowing less than they should.
Mm-hmm.
But to really do the best work possible, if you're on the web, yes, you should absolutely know JavaScript and be comfortable with it. And it has its flaws, and there's some good workarounds for a lot of those flaws. And just go ahead and embrace it. You know, realize that it is what it is. It's not perfect, but it has such incredibly broad reach that it's just worth looking past some of the warts that it does have.
Cool. Well, thanks for hanging out. I appreciate it.
Yeah, sure. It was great talking to you.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.